Across the UK, across continental North America, and around the world, on the internet, by webcast and by podcast, my name is Howard Hughes, and this is The Return of the Unexplained. Thank you very much for the nice things you've been saying to me on email. Now that we've got our contact problems fixed, we now have a new place for you to go on the website, www.theunexplained.tv, and you can email me direct from there. And I love to hear from you. You've said some really nice things. And it's also good that you've been mentioning recently, and I know he will appreciate that, Adam Cornwell, my webmaster at Creative Hotspot in Liverpool. Adam has worked really hard on this show. I could not do any of this without him. I'm enormously grateful, and from your emails, it seems you are too. I know, as I say, Adam will greatly appreciate that. Now, since I last appeared here, there's been a very big and seismic development in the world of broadcasting, and it's one that's made me very, very happy, and many, many other people too. The return to the airwaves of Art Bell, with his new Sirius XM satellite radio show called Dark Matter. There are many reasons why I am delighted that Art Bell is back. Here in the UK, he's always inspired me. I've been talking about these topics on radio for years. But one day when I got my first computer, I found this guy in America doing a show clearly from his own home, controlling everything himself and talking about all of this stuff. Art Bell, you may never know, but you inspired me to do this. You gave me permission to go ahead. So Art Bell, for personal reasons and professional ones, I welcome you back to the airwaves and I'll be listening. On the subject of this show and how it started and where it's going, I want to talk very briefly about a subject that I almost never mention these days. Because I was brought up, as I'm sure many of us were, never to talk about money. It was just seen to be impolite. The problem that I have with The Unexplained is that the show is now reaching more people than ever. We've doubled our listening in the last year, which is staggering. We're doing really well in America. And we depend on donations. Now, the interesting thing is a phenomenon's happening here, and I don't quite understand how it works. The listening has doubled, but the donations have more than halved. And I think it's partly because, and I totally understand this, people think that everything on the internet needs to be free. And I think when it's big organizations, yes, it should, because they have enough money anyway. Or if it's an individual who's got another career and has the money, that's fine. In my case, I worked in radio, I worked on big stations, but I never made any money, so I've bankrolled this myself, and I can't continue to do it, unfortunately. So what's happened in my life, I will continue to do The Unexplained, but I've taken a job that will start very soon and will mean a lot of hard work. I'm hoping that it means I can still do as many shows because this is my first and main love, and I want to develop this, and I know we can. So that explains where we're going at the moment. I may have to find another funding option for the show at some point, but I really want this to continue. And so many of you say such nice things about me. When I feel that I don't want to go on, you pick me up and help me, especially around the time when my father died this year. Thank you. Okay, I want to do some shout-outs, but just before I do, I want to say thank you to Martin. Martin is the guy, if you're a regular listener, who made our original theme tune, then updated it, and now has done me an update of the update. And at the end of this show, I want you to tell me what you think of it when I play some of it. So I didn't play it at the beginning, I will play it at the end. And just email me. Go to www.theunexplained.tv. Tell me what you think of the new version of the theme, and we can maybe make changes if they're needed or whatever. Quickly, Comet Ison, or is it Eason? I-S-O-N. I have a good friend who is very, very worried about this and feels that it's heading towards us and is going to leave us with some problems, possibly through its effect on the sun, but maybe in other ways. I keep trying to get information about this, and I keep hitting a brick wall. Do you know anything about this, or do you know anybody who does? I would be keen to know. It may be nothing, maybe something. All right, shout-outs, got to get to those quickly before the guest this time, Tim Good. British UFO man, a fantastic guest, new book out in November this year. Hi to Kevin Eusen, E-U-S-O-N, is it Eusen? In Holland, Kevin, thank you. Peter Lloyd in New Zealand, good to hear from you again, Peter, glad to know you're getting through. Sterla Silton in Norway, thank you very much. Michaela French, thank you. Danny Foxwell, thank you. Sean in Raccoon Rapids, USA, I think it is. Sean, thank you very much, good to hear from you. And Shannon Wood in a place whose name I've always loved, because it always sounds like something out of a Humphrey Bogart movie, doesn't it? So we're going to meet in Spokane, Washington. Shannon, lovely to hear from you. And look, in the last month or so, I've had hundreds of emails, so that is only a tiny, tiny slice off the top. I will get round to shouting out to other people if you've emailed in the near future, but we're kind of out of time for that right now. So let's cross now to a man who is always fascinating. I normally do a fair amount of research for every edition of The Unexplained. With this man, I am deliberately not going to, because I want to see where the conversation goes. Timothy Good. We'll have a link to him on our website, theunexplained.tv. Timothy Good in southeast London on the Kent border. Lovely to have you on again.
Thank you very much.
As I say, and as I said to my listeners, Tim, you are one of my favourite guests because you always leave us fascinated. And you are a guest who I tend to break my rules about. And one of my rules is, because journalism taught me to do this, that I tend to do fairly meticulous preparation for guests. I want to know where the conversation is going. And when I get you on, it's much better if I don't do that. I can trust you to the extent that we will steer this conversation and we'll take this ship whichever port it's headed for, and it'll be fine. You know, that's
okay.
And I don't think you can say anything better than that about a guest. So what have you been up to lately?
Well, my new book is coming out in about, I don't know, 4, 5, 6 weeks, something like that.
Indeed, it's slated in the UK for November, isn't it? So we want to get into that fairly extensively.
Yes, it's published in New York, and it's called Earth, an Alien Enterprise, and I hope it'll do well, and there seems to be a lot of interest in it, so that's good news.
I've often wondered, and I don't think I've ever asked any of my guests on this show, and I've never heard this question asked, but I'll ask you because I know you won't mind. You are accomplished in what you do. You are a guest on a lot of shows like America's Coast to Coast AM and a lot of other shows too, including mine. When you're not doing this stuff and you're not writing, what do you do? What do you do with yourself?
Well, I'm also a professional violinist, and although I don't get as much work as I used to, I still do mostly freelance work, playing mostly for symphony and what they call chamber orchestra concerts, which I still enjoy. And that entails traveling around the country sometimes. But in fact, I've got one this week, later on this week on Friday, down in Guildford in Surrey.
Excellent.
And a few more, a rehearsal on the Sunday following that for another symphony orchestra for a concert.
Well, I wish you well with that. I mean, there is nothing more exacting than being a professional musician. You have to get it right.
We try.
Well, listen, I don't think I ever asked you that question. Maybe I did in the deep and distant past, but thank you for answering it. I don't know whether anybody else has ever asked you that, but I was always keen to know, because there always seemed to be more to you than what we discuss on the show.
Possibly. I mean, definitely in the case of the music profession, that's for sure.
Now, your biography, which I did read, that was the only bit of preparation I did for this, told me something that I must have forgotten in the mists of time, that your interest in this began, is this right, 1955?
Absolutely correct. I'll tell you how it all came about. I've always been mad about aircraft and space travel. And an American cousin was visiting, staying with us, my parents and my brother and myself, for a few weeks. And he, actually, very interesting chap. He was the first person to produce a magazine on computers, and it was called Computers and Automation, and that was in about 1946-47. And his name was Edmund C. Berkeley. He's long since deceased, but he was a brilliant guy, had an extraordinary brain.
And this was in the era when computers, there was one, I think, at, was it Manchester or was it UMIST, the University of Manchester Institute of Science and Technology?
It was the size of a block of flats.
It was the size of a very large hall. That's the truth of it. So this is very, very early days.
Yes, it was. And I can remember him to this day saying, Timothy, do you think machines will be able to think? And I thought, no.
And now, of course, with AI, we're getting very close to that.
Artificial intelligence, absolutely, yes. But the interesting thing is, he said, Timothy, you like airplanes, you need to know about flying saucers. And so, He sent me a book by Major Donald Kehoe called The Flying Saucers Are Real. And this was all about, as I'm sure you're aware, sightings by airline pilots and fighter pilots and other civilian pilots. And I was absolutely hooked. And, you know, some people say, oh, yes, you know, but pilots aren't any special. They make mistakes too. And I said, yeah, but radar doesn't usually. And radar actually is far more sophisticated than people believe, even in the 1950s. I mean, I see it. There's a certain UFO researcher who I won't name, who keeps going on about all sorts of false signals that radar is subject to. It is not. It is not. Radar is phenomenally well developed. I was told by some military naval guys about 20 years ago, if not more than that, actually, it could have been 25 years ago, that the Americans at that time had radar. It's called there's line of sight radar and there's over the horizon radar, which gets bounced on satellites or another aircraft or whatever. Mm. But the Americans had such sophisticated radar in those days that they were able actually to train it on, say, a Russian bear bomber or something like that, and they could tell from the turbine blades what sort of aircraft it was just from radar interfacing with the impeller blades on the gas turbine jets.
So the technology to be very, very accurate with what you're detecting has really always been there.
Yes.
And what can we infer from that?
Well, I don't know. It's just that I don't think most people are aware of all that, even to this day. But radar is incredibly accurate, and it's thank God, very seldom when things go wrong. But
I was reminded recently, you know, Tim, about a celebrated case that I don't know as much about as I should have known about. And this is the case, I'm sure you'll know this one, of a Japanese JAL airline that I think was flying over the northern route,
that's Anchorage,
the Greenland.
Alaska.
Yes, yeah.
November 1986.
And this is a truly fascinating case because this aircraft spotted, the flight crew spotted something hugely anomalous following them. It was tracked, wasn't it?
The plane was just a drop of dust in comparison to the size of this thing. It was absolutely huge. It must have been, I don't know, half a mile in width, something like that, I would guess.
But wasn't it tracked by Anchorage or Fairbanks?
Yes, it was. Hmm? It was. And at least one other passenger airliner saw it. Of course, that plane, that Japan Airlines plane was not holding passengers. It just had crew and an awful lot of, I think it was Beaujolais wine on board or something for delivery in Anchorage.
And as far as you know, and there is a lot of apocryphal stuff out there, we know, but the crew of this plane, how were they after this incident?
I think they were slightly disturbed by it. They didn't know, if this thing might attack them. They were very nervous. Just put it like that. I can't recall a great deal more, but I know that it was looked into by the Americans, obviously, because it was over United States airspace.
And the thing that piqued my interest about it is that, all right, a lot of these things are debunked regularly, and people say, well, it's radar reflections, and it's this, and it's that. But the site that I looked at, there was a very, very comprehensive account of it, actually filtered out and factored out the possibility of error. So when you boiled it all down, you were left with a very, very real radar trace of something truly deeply anomalous.
Absolutely. And the CIA got very interested in it. I know that there were several meetings with I think, the crew. I don't know where the meetings took place, possibly in Washington, but there was quite an intensive investigation into that case in particular.
Tim, my show seems to be going in a very strange direction. I haven't really planned it this way, but I've done quite a few shows lately about UFOs and ufology, just at the time when I'd said earlier this year on this show that we weren't really getting as many sightings and not as many things were happening. Suddenly a whole raft of people come forward, and I've had a lot of people who've given me very compelling accounts of lifetime abduction.
Interesting.
It is interesting, and more of these people seem to be certainly presenting themselves to me And, you know, you can easily say, well, this is, in one case, for example, Wilbur Allen, who was my last guest on here, who lived as a child on an RAF, well, not an RAF, it was an RAF American Air Force base, staffed by US personnel in East Anglia. It's now been decommissioned. But he was a kid here, and he was first, he says, abducted at the age of five, and those abductions continued throughout his life.
I can believe it.
He also says, and the thing that I wanted to ask you about, because I wondered if you'd heard this before, that wherever he's gone in his life, right up to the present day, this phenomena, these phenomena, have followed him.
Interesting. I've heard of other cases like that.
But I wonder, and, you know, in life you have other things to do, so you think about other things, and the thought goes away, but it has occurred to me many, many times. How do the people who are abducted like that, or say they're abducted, or believe they've been abducted, how on earth do they cope with that?
I think in some cases, people I know, with difficulty, for example, in my new book, there's a chapter about a lot of stuff going on in Puerto Rico. This is since I last wrote anything about Puerto Rico. I've written a lot about it because I've visited the Commonwealth of the United States on seven occasions. But I interviewed at length, mostly via emails, with a lady called Maria Rivera, whose entire family has been abducted. She, to start off with, and she says she's absolutely convinced that the beings that abducted her, they might have had some good intentions, but she felt that they do not have our best interests at heart. And I concur with that absolutely. I think my information from reliable sources around the world, people who really do appear to understand what's going on, is that the abductions are for the purpose of creating hybrids.
And that is exactly what Wilbur Allen said, because Wilbur Allen is the son, a child of mixed-race parents.
Right.
And he's always believed his whole life long that that is why they were interested in him.
Could well be.
And that, of course, charts back to the Betty and Barney Hill case.
Yes. But Maria has had, you know, some quite frightening experiences. They performed an operation on her, actually to cure her of cancer. But she said that was the good side of it. The bad side of it was they did that so that they could use her body for the several months that they do to develop their fetus, and then they take it out and it's developed. And now my overall understanding of the object of the exercise from informed sources is that they're definitely creating a hybridized race, a cross species between human beings and those particular bug-eyed variety of beings.
And
the
this is often
of which is
yes.
to take over the planet. That's what I've been told. I'm not sure.
Okay.
It depends what time of day it is or what my state of mind is, but that is what I have been told. The purpose of the exercise is to try and take over this planet with the hybrids so that they can interface with everything on this planet better than they can at the moment.
You don't have to name names, but you said you have been told.
Yeah, but
so what sort of people have told you that?
No, name names, but I mean,
what sort of person?
David Jacobs would certainly agree with me. I think he's, you know, a man I much admire. I'm hoping to meet him next week. He's giving a presentation at Oxford University next. It's Wednesday the 9th, actually, in Oxford, and he's going to be moseying around London as well for a few days, so I'm looking forward to seeing him and his wife. He's a great guy. I have great respect for his work.
I would love to speak with him.
Well,
but that's a possibility that I'll have to get my bloodhound sense of tracking people down. So you are saying that, unlike a lot of people who say, well, actually, we think that if this hybridization is going on, the idea is to create a hybrid race for the race that is doing the abducting to sustain itself. You don't think that that washes? You think there's more to this than meets the eye?
Well, I do. It's been going on since the 1940s, at least, and it's supposed to be a 100-year operation. That's what I've been told.
100 years, that's a specific time frame, so we're getting very close to this event happening then.
Well, allegedly, if it's all still going on and we haven't been able to stop them, it quite likely.
And when you say if we haven't been able to stop them, do you think that there are people who are doing that?
Yes. There are the good guys and the bad guys. Interestingly, there's I've written at great length in my new book about the so-called amicizia case. It's the amicizia is Italian for friendship, and it relates to, I think, something that went on for 40 years, liaison with human beings from other planets, very similar to us, some dissimilar, but many of them very similar. I'm showing a photograph of a 10-foot-tall alien that was taken in Italy by a Catholic historian. It's absolutely genuine. I've spoken to people who've had like 40 years of meetings with these guys, and this went on not just in Italy, but many countries around the world, such as Chile, where a lot of stuff goes on in any case. And a great deal of information was passed by these people, and my information is that they have given us their technology. Now, this has been going on, I've been told, by several informed sources since the 1950s. We have not only duplicated the technology, we have been given craft. Now, you'd think, why on earth would they let us humans have their craft and the technology? Well, the answer is quite simple. They need our help in dealing with these supposed evil aliens. And that's what I've been told. I've even been told precisely, like numbers of people, like 10 Italian Air Force pilots were flying these craft at one time. I don't know the exact the dates, but this is...
So all of this stuff does not involve the Americans or the British all the time. There are other countries involved.
Oh, absolutely. No question about it.
That's staggering. I mean, you don't hear very much about that. But the other thing that's interesting, the dynamic of this as you describe it is very much like it is here on Earth, that sometimes if you want to get a particular outcome, if you want a particular set of people to win, you will then arm that side. And you're saying that one group of aliens has given us the technology
they
to be able to fight off another.
Yes, absolutely.
So do you go with this theory that there are dogfights happening in the skies above our heads every night?
I think that's been going on since the 1940s.
And the people have told you that this is a 100-year project. Obviously, we cannot breach their confidentiality or name any names here. But you're obviously confident of their credibility.
If you like, if you can just give me a sec, I'll get hold of my manuscript and I'll just try and find some information which is highly detailed about these guys.
Absolutely. So here we're talking with Tim Good, Timothy Good, who is always an excellent guest on these matters. He's previewing for us his new book that is due to be published during November and is bound to be a worldwide hit, and I'm sure you'll hear him speaking in the coming weeks and months on other outlets, but we have him here first, and I'm very, very pleased that we have.
Hi, I'm back.
Okay.
Alas, I can't memorize absolutely everything.
I know exactly where you're coming from. There is so much data. How long is the book? How many pages?
Well, I don't know, because I won't get my copy for about 10 days, something like that.
So you haven't seen it?
So I haven't actually seen the book, you know, but it's like about 400 pages of my manuscript anyway. Mm. So
this is going to be at least a 300, 350-page book,
I
think.
I mean, things have been going on. I mean, apparently, for example, a president as well as a chairman of the Joint Chiefs, that's the Joint Chiefs of Staff in the States, are alleged to have been abducted. And there's a barely known report which came out in 1982, which I've saved, and I've published it here for the first time. It was in the Evening Standard, a British evening paper, relating to General William Westmoreland, who was a U.S. Army general in command of military operations in the Vietnam War. And this newspaper story states that a report that America's Vietnam commander, General William Westmoreland, had been snatched by a flying saucer sparked off a full-scale emergency alert. It names the witness who heard about this, Mrs. Edith Mello, and security police immediately tried to track down the general. They failed, and troops at El Paso Army Base in Texas were put on full alert. The search was eventually called off, but later on, the Army confirmed that General Westmoreland had been found, but they refused to say where.
Okay, well, knowing the military as I do and you do, do you not think that that's not kind of some cover story for something else? Because we know that the military and governments, both sides of the Atlantic, have sometimes used this phenomenon to cover up things they were really doing.
Yes.
But you think this was the real deal?
I don't know. I wasn't there. But regarding the aliens, would you like to know what I've actually been told by a very well-informed American source?
Or would I? Absolutely.
Okay. The alien species described by, this is my source, said they lived for several hundreds of years. Anatomically, they had a bi-chambered heart and a single lung served to oxygenate their blood and tissues and to eliminate bodily wastes in gaseous form. Vegetable-based food was liquefied and its nutrients absorbed through their tissues, not gastronomically. Their genitals were similar to ours, but those of the male were much smaller. Regarding the modus operandi relating to the alien hybridization process, the wombs of their females are much smaller than those of humans, thus unable to accommodate transgenic fetuses for more than 2 months. Hence, human wombs were favored. Cross-species copulation per se was very seldom employed, since the alien male organs were too soft. Mm. Thus, artificial insemination prevailed. The fetuses, extracted prematurely after the two-month period, were nurtured somehow until reaching term at 7 months. In addition to their cross-breeding experiments, these aliens supposedly had experimented with various types of bacteria and viruses, which gave rise for concern. Though generally thinner and shorter and with somewhat larger heads and eyes, the hybridized men and women appeared human. Some of both sexes appeared well-formed, even good-looking. However, at that time anyway, we're looking back about 30 years here, I guess, Howard, they were unable to vocalize as we do, owing to underdeveloped tongues and larynxes. By way of food, they consumed nothing solid. Some of these hybrids lived in the aliens' bases on Earth, others elsewhere, including their own planets. Only a few lived among us. That's the greys we're talking about here. The aliens reckoned it would take around 100 years for them to infiltrate our planet. So that's quite interesting.
Infiltrate, that's a very interesting word to use.
Yeah.
And do you go along with the theory, as some people have expressed over the years, that there were aliens actually living on or near Area 51?
Yes, I do. I don't have too many details, but it has been confirmed for me that they've had aliens there and craft.
And again, the veracity of that source, you're confident that you've been given very good information?
I think so, yes. I can't be 100% sure, of course.
Plenty of detail there. How does it make you, as a human being, Tim, how does it make you feel to hear an account like that?
Well, I'm sort of been exposed to it for such a long time that I've got used to these wild theories. And I certainly believe quite a few of them, I must say.
So, all right. There is hybridization going on, and there is a battle over and about us.
Apparently. Now, I can't tell you what's going on now. That information may be way out of date now. I have no idea exactly what's going on right now.
Give me a snapshot, then, of the journey that this book takes. Obviously, I don't want you to give away your best points, but give us a taste of flavor.
Heavens. You've got me. Well, I've got, I think, 19 chapters. I've described in the introduction, you know, we hear a lot about reports in the United Kingdom, in the United States, of UFO sightings. And I've mentioned some fairly dramatic ones in the United Kingdom that we've had in the last few years. And I also describe some from a lot of events in China, including an encounter reported with a UFO by the crew of the Shenzhou 9 spacecraft. That was just a year or two ago, I think.
That you don't hear a lot about these things from China. What do you think their attitude to all of this is?
They do put out stuff occasionally, but most of the time we pick up this thing and the news feeds, I guess, and they're translated. Mm. But there's a lot going on. There's a lot going on in China.
And do you think that all of this material that you've gathered, do you think it is now making an even more compelling case that as a species, as a group of people living on this planet, I'm not talking about governments or military organizations, the military-industrial complex, whatever you want to call it, but as humanity, that we need to wake up and do something, and if we do, what do you think we need to do?
very good question, Howard. I honestly, I don't know. I don't know. I imagine that the situation is being taken care of to the best extent by those who do have our best interests at heart. And I mean people like aliens. And I'm talking about the ones that are obviously related to us, genetically related to us.
And what do you hope that people who buy this new book that isn't out yet, what do you hope that they will take away from it?
A lot of new information, a lot of new theories, a lot of data that's just not been published before, which gives a sort of different spin to the whole situation.
One thing that has occurred to me, and certainly I've been researching this, you know, reading about it since I was a boy and then doing this unexplained show for a while, it's always fascinated me. There is a lot of trash out there. There's a lot of misinformation. It seems to me that there are a lot of deluded and misguided people. But even when you cut through all of that, there is still a substratum of something there. There is a common thread of some kind of truth in amongst all of that white noise.
Absolutely.
And that's the fascinating thing. That is the thing that researchers have to dig their way through.
Yes.
There is stuff that cannot be explained. I mean, there is a guy in Scotland who I had on this show, I think about 2 months ago, called Dave Munro. Are you aware of Dave Munro?
I've heard of him.
All right, Dave Munro is a wonderful man in Scotland, and he was introduced to me by an organization called Amash and Joanne Summerscales.
Okay.
Dave Munro tells the most amazing stories of things that happen on the beaches near the Lossiemouth RAF base up there.
Way
up north of Scotland. And we were talking about balls of light in the sky and things whizzing over people's heads.
Oh, well, thank you for telling me that, because...
Well, Dave is not saying too much about all of this now, from what I say. Dave, if you're listening to this, I'd love to hear from you again.
Because I've got a section by a Scottish friend of mine who was in the Royal Air Force, and he's described his sightings, you know, and he was very qualified to talk about them. He had several encounters in Scotland, and he was actually threatened by the... a boss of one of the Air Force bases he was at, who said, this subject is the most sensitive subject, and you must never talk about it, you saw. Because he's seen several craft, you know.
And you know, that is, again, gives the lie to the thought that all of this stuff happens out in the Arizona desert. Not
yes.
So.
It's all over. It's not everywhere, that's for sure, but some countries are visited more than others. I just wanted to make the point that there are different kinds of so-called greys. We tend to compartmentalize them, and I'm doing that in a way, but they're not all involved in hybridization and things like that. Some of them definitely have our best interests at heart.
Okay, because the greys are commonly seen as the bad guys. I remember Art Bell, my American radio hero, who, of course, you've been on his show a number of times, and I think you're going to be again.
Yes, I'm going to be then, I think, 24th of October, something like that.
Well, that'll be a great show, and I will listen to that. I'm sure he'll do a full 3 hours with you about all of this.
4 hours, actually.
Okay. Well, he had...
Three in the morning to seven in the morning.
Yeah, no, he loves the nocturnal thing, keeping late hours. But he used to have a song, and the song he used to play was, it was a country and western style song, you may have heard it. If ever I get abducted, please let it not be the greys. But you're saying there's more to that than we should assume.
Well, you know, I've got a, talking about these greys, I have a whole chapter supplied to me by an ex-Royal Air Force guy who for two and a half years, something like that, 1955 to 57, he was sort of more or less in charge of a team of six people who'd been handpicked, this is during the National Service, to take care of two aliens, greys, but not at all of the nasty type, quite the contrary, highly telepathic, absolutely extraordinary details, and this chap and his team, I'm aware of most of their names. Unfortunately, I've not been able to publish any of them at the moment, but I'm hoping that inquiries will be made, and my source is prepared to reveal all when he's approached. But I have not put his real name in the book. There's a whole chapter on it. The most extraordinary thing is these guys were very peaceful. They had been injured in the Roswell incident, one of the several aliens who had been injured. And some escaped. It's a very complex story. And they had been kept by the Americans, and they got pissed off with the way the Americans were treating with them, and they insisted and threatened that they absolutely must be taken to the United Kingdom because they felt that they would be better treated there. Isn't that, it's extraordinary. I know it's an outrageous story, Howard, but...
It's a fair stretch of credulity, but if you've got somebody out there, if you've got somebody out there who's willing to come out and spill the beans about that,
absolutely,
then there must
yes.
be more to it than
oh,
meets
yes,
the eye.
Oh, yes, I think several names will come forward when the book is published. As I say, I resisted the temptation to quote actual names. I was requested not to, but those people have said that they will come forward if necessary with their real names.
It's often said, and you often read, that the British royal family know more about this than perhaps meets the eye. And certainly the Duke of Edinburgh, I've always believed, has more than a passing interest in all of this. And certainly if you
he
read...
does. He's very well informed. I've occasionally been in touch with him since back in 1987. Just very, very occasionally by letters, you know, between his equerry and myself. But as a matter of fact, a copy of my book will be presented in person to him. Not by me, but by... your friend.
Well, the Duke of Edinburgh, I think, gets a bad rap sometimes in the media here, but I think he's a very astute man, and I think he knows a great deal.
And furthermore, there's evidence that he was present when the initial, debriefing about that situation at these two Royal Air Force bases, reported by my Royal Air Force friend. My friend says that, in his opinion, Prince Philip was there. I've not written that in the book, but...
I remember being told when this show was on national radio in the UK, and you came on that show, one of my guests, I don't think it was you, it may have been, said to me, Howard, you need to know that somebody very important is going to be listening to your show tonight. And I had a feeling that it might well be him.
I didn't have him in mind, and I can't think who it was.
Oh, well, it may have just been the chief executive of the radio company. Who knows?
I don't know. I'm sorry.
But that's a long time ago and far away. But I've always believed that, they know. And, of course, if you read on the internet, there is a story that does the rounds, and the detail of it appears differently in different places, that the Duke of Edinburgh is said to have had a meeting with an alien.
Well, actually, no, it not quite like that. He might have done, but my information comes from Air Marshal Sir Peter Horsley, who was Deputy Chief of Strike Command back in 1954, with his finger on the nuclear trigger. And he told me, and he's written about it in his autobiography, that in 1954, a British Army general arranged for a two-hour meeting with an alien being in Chelsea. And... this meeting lasted, as I say, for 2 hours, during which this very human-appearing alien, dressed immaculately in a suit, tie, shirt and everything, gave a lot of information to Air Marshal Sir Peter Horsley. And what Sir Peter told me, what baffled him more than anything else, was the fact that this man could read his mind absolutely. Furthermore, he knew all Britain's top secret nuclear secrets, and these guys were getting worried about our nuclear arsenal. And the effect it would have on this planet if too many bombs were exploding and things like that. And that was back in 1954.
And so, do you agree with these stories that the aliens, such as they are, do take a tremendous interest in our nuclear capability?
Yes, they do.
Why do you think that may be?
Because they have a vested interest in this planet, and some of them actually care about what will happen to the population and... everything that's on this planet. The Earth is, I'm told, unique. Not in the galaxy, obviously, but in this neck of the woods, it's unique, which makes it very popular. But I think there have been some people here longer than we have, and we are a hybridized species.
Mm. And what about this technology that we've been given? The flying technology, whatever technology it may be. Got it, and what are they doing with it?
Well, it's being used because we have been given some of their craft. We've been told exactly how they fly, and quite a number of our people are flying these things.
You told me the Italian story. That certainly is an eyebrow raiser.
Also Gordon Cooper, who I corresponded with for quite a while, but he never told me this in person, but a very close friend of his told me that he, Gordon Cooper...
This is the astronaut, Gordon Cooper.
He said, I get so frustrated, he was at a United Nations meeting, I think it was in 1978, mm-hmm. talking about the subject, and he was so frustrated because nobody in the UN could take it seriously. And he said, what does it take? Do I have to fly a craft and land it in front of the United Nations? And I thought he was joking. In fact, he would have done just that, because he was flying these craft, and so quite a number of other astronauts have been flying alien vehicles for quite some time.
Problem is, there is a great amount of mush out there. We talked about this white noise, and we try and filter the truth through all of this white noise.
Yes.
There is a video going around at the moment on YouTube. There's a lot of stuff around at the moment on YouTube. But it is a fairly credible-looking man who claims to have been a member of the CIA, who's getting up in years and is, it looks rather ill. I mean, he looks, I hope he isn't
yes,
as ill as he appears.
Quite a while back.
And what did you think of that?
I'm not sure.
Because he says they're quite...
I really don't know. I think he seems genuine.
Well, I tend to listen to the way that people speak and the rhythms of their speech.
Yes.
And I've seen a lot of garbage. I mean, there's another thing going around on the internet at the moment about Michael Jackson's last phone call. You've probably seen that one as well. I don't particularly believe that or the guy who presents it, because it's just done in too Alfred Hitchcock theatrical a way. But this guy, if you were going to talk to somebody like that, you would invite him to a hotel room and you would sit him in the corner by the bed and you'd sit on the corner of the bed and you'd get his story. And the way that he delivers it, and what he says, effectively, I mean, look it up on the internet. It's pretty easy to find. A lot of people are posting it.
Yes, I've seen it.
And what he says is, sounds, in the way that it's delivered, credible.
Yes,
that we've been doing this for years, and he wants to get this information out before he's no longer here to do it.
Yeah.
Do you think we're going to get more revelations like that?
I'm sure.
Because the thing that concerns me more than anything else, and recently we had the death, sadly, of Jesse Marcel Jr. I never got the chance to speak to him. I don't know if you did.
I did on quite a few occasions. Yes, a very nice man. Several occasions, anyway.
And I've asked other guests this. When you met him and you looked into the whites of his eyes, did you have any reason to disbelieve what he was saying?
Not at all. And neither did a guy who was doing some researching several witnesses when he was helping a United States senator, and I was helping this guy as well, and he interviewed Marcel at considerable length and got a lot of information from him. He told me he found him completely convincing.
So a great loss to us. It seems to me that an awful lot of people who have these stories to tell are getting up in years, or they're dying off, and we're losing them. And we don't seem to be getting younger people coming out and telling these stories, or do we?
Well, I think as time goes by, more will be revealed. I'm sure of that.
What are you proudest of in this new book, Tim?
Heavens.
Well, what's the story, the bit of information? You told me a couple. The bit of information that you're proudest of. You know, as people who chronicle events and as journalists, well, there's always something that we are particularly proud of inside.
I think possibly that it's the overview of the whole situation, which I've tried to explain, and it's not me that's done this alone. I've been given a lot of help on these issues, but I think it gives a very interesting overview and perspective on the whole situation regarding this planet and the various aliens who have vested interests.
You do a lot of work in America. You are known in America. When you do a show over there, or you get yourself in print over there, do people get in touch with you and tell you their stories?
All the time, actually, from all over the place. I've had that, which I'm always grateful for.
And what sorts of things have they said? You can remember one or two, maybe.
Oh, heavens. I mean, I wouldn't know where to start, Howard. Mm. I mean, so many people, I think, are reluctant to voice their experiences, say, with aliens and abductions and things like that. But I get a lot of emails that, and I always answer them unless they're absolutely kooky, you know. I will answer them, and some of them seem to me to be very, very convincing. But these people are not reluctant to go on the public record often.
Are there ever times when you as a researcher doubt the veracity or the credibility of any of this stuff? Are there ever times when you think, well, maybe I am barking up the wrong tree, or are you completely convinced now?
I think regarding certain aspects, yes, I wonder if I'm barking up the wrong tree about certain aspects, because there's an awful lot I don't know. I mean, I'm ignorant about. But I'm very, very lucky to have very well-informed sources, the sort of people whose names can never be mentioned, who are very deeply concerned.
Well, that Italian material that you talked about is absolute dynamite. Absolute dynamite.
That is dynamite, and it was partly taken from a book called Mass Contacts by Professor Stefano Breccia, who became a friend. I got to know him, and my girlfriend and I went to talk with him and get a lot of information from him, because he'd given a lot of information about this amicizia, which he was associated with this group for 40 years. And he was a professor, scientist, qualified. He was a pilot. And he had meetings with human-type aliens over a period of 40 years. And he gave me a great deal of information. Not only that, he also gave me a lot of information relating to precise details of the propulsion systems used by these aliens. So there's a lot of that in the book. It's a long chapter called Amicizia, a lot of information, it was a revelation to me to have all that data.
And what about the Vatican's interest in this material, and vice versa, the aliens' interest in the Vatican?
Well, George Adamski, who is much maligned often, actually was extremely well informed. He had United States government ordnance card, which gave him access to all military bases, not just in the United States, but throughout the world, all United States military bases. And he exercised that. He had meetings with generals and presidents. He had meetings with President Kennedy, for example, and he introduced some of the aliens allegedly to President Kennedy. And
that's interesting, isn't it? Because we're coming up to that big anniversary of Kennedy's assassination, and it's always been claimed that because Kennedy knew so much about it, he had to be shut up.
Well, there are probably other reasons for it, but I think certainly the alien situation was one of them, because he and Marilyn Monroe were close to sort of revealing stuff about, you know, their knowledge about the subject. Marilyn Monroe, apparently, because she was having an affair, I think, both the Kennedys were having an affair with her. Mm. And she, I think, became privy to some of the information about the alien situation. So there's a lot. And Adamski actually had two meetings with Pope John the 23rd and an earlier meeting with Pope Pius, or Pius, I don't know how it's pronounced. And both of those popes apparently had actual meetings with aliens in the Vatican, private meetings with aliens in the Vatican. So there is a, behind the scenes, there's been a lot going on. It sounds outrageous, I know, but...
Well, the Vatican, as we've said many times on this show, and we've talked it round and round in circles, and I'm never really sure whether we got very far with it, but the Vatican has a provable, demonstrable interest in the skies. It has an observatory.
Yes, in the United States, I believe. It probably has another one, too, somewhere in the Vatican Gardens, but they've always been interested in astronomy.
And what do you think about the words of Paul Hellyer, former Defence Minister of Canada? I spoke to him about a month ago just after his 90th birthday. It was a great delight to be able to get him.
Yes.
And he's always amazing. And he is even firmer in his resolve that all of this stuff is true.
Yes. I've had quite a bit of correspondence with him, and I think we chatted on the phone once he has a home in Canada. And he's a former prime minister, as you know.
Former defence minister, yes.
Defence minister, sorry, yes. I beg your pardon, I get that confused sometimes. And he was certainly well informed about some things by an American general who told him it was all real. The only thing that he believes, for example, he says he's written in one of his books, I'm the only person who says that some of these aliens do not have our best intentions. He thinks they're all wonderful, which I think is very naive. So that's the only thing that we beg to differ on, quite seriously.
And when we look at the current crop of politicians, Cameron in the UK, Obama in the US, do you think the aliens have entrusted them with information? I mean, sometimes I look at both of them and I wonder how we entrust them with the running of the country.
I doubt very much whether Cameron has been given any information. I might be in a position to find out. I know that
really?
Tony Blair had some sort of briefing, but I don't. I my understanding it was relatively superficial. Relatively superficial briefing about the UFO situation.
And when you say
quite a number of years ago.
Okay, is that the kind of briefing that it is claimed that prime ministers and presidents get when they take up office, or was there more to that?
It depends. Usually, they. I don't think in the United Kingdom. I don't think that subject comes up very often, but it certainly has in the past. And. Mm. I think Blair had left office by the time that information was passed to him, and I might be able to find out exactly what information was and or wasn't passed on to him. But
amazing, though, if politicians have been taken into the confidence of aliens or the confidence of those who are connected with aliens, the military people perhaps, that more politicians haven't come out and spilled the beans and told us what they know.
Well, I think, quite frankly, Howard, I think mostly, relatively few politicians get briefed on the subject. It's something that is treated, is dealt with by the military at very, very high levels of top secret.
And not the military-industrial complex, just the military?
Well, there is a military-industrial complex, that is absolutely for sure. I used to think it was, well, it is a conspiracy theory, but what's wrong with theorizing about conspiracies? And there's a lot about that in my book from a guy who had the highest position in the CIA without being a member of the CIA. It's quite a story. I've got a half chapter on it. An extraordinary guy. I had the pleasure of meeting.
And give me a sliver of what he says?
Well, I mean, he, for example, he had top secret clearance. He had access to all sorts of things. And he was on board a military plane flying across the Atlantic when there was a huge flying disc which just accompanied the plane for well over half an hour. All these military guys on board. And he gave me top secret information about that, which I published in, I think it was Beyond Top Secret. I think I published it in that book.
And that disc, was it one of theirs or one of ours?
I don't know. Very good question.
Because we have, as you said, they've given us this technology. We have these things.
Yes.
If we have them, I often wonder, especially here in the UK, it's a small country, where do we put them?
I don't know. I'm sure that there are even at conventional military airfields, there's all sorts of stuff that goes on underground, storing military weapons for.
Well, certainly in America, they say it's Wright, the real place for all of that is Wright-Patterson, Wright Pat.
It certainly was. Whether it still is, I honestly don't know, Howard.
Anything that we haven't covered about the book before I ask you about something else?
It's got 19 chapters.
And I think we've talked about five of them.
I don't know. There's just so much going on. I mean, for example, I think that Dr. Henry Kissinger has been involved since the 1940s when he was in charge of the Office of Special Studies, which dealt with the then top secret alien situation. Well, it's still top secret, but that was in the 1940s. Kissinger was very well placed, and he still is, I can tell you, very well informed about the subject.
And why would he, when he was in office, I can understand, and he is a very connected man with an incredible brain, of course he is. When he was in office, I can imagine that being the case, but even when he's been out of office and in retirement, semi-retirement, whatever he wants to call it?
I think he's 90 now. Mm. It might even be more than that, I'm not sure, but he's a sharp guy, and definitely he has been at least involved in that situation since the 1940s, according to information provided by Bill Steinman, William Steinman, a very good Californian researcher who first published it. He talked to the wife of a guy who was working in the Office of Special Studies with Kissinger and everything. And this woman relayed to Bill Steinman in a recorded telephone conversation that Kissinger was in charge of the whole operation relating to UFOs from the 1940s. Whether he still is, I don't know.
sounds to me, and I was going to ask you this, so I'll ask it you now. If there was one person that you could perhaps fly to America or somewhere to meet and ask a question, who would that be? It sounds to me like it would be Kissinger.
Yeah, why not? I'd like that. He knows about me, I gather, so... You'd be surprised. Some of the things that are going on there are absolutely extraordinary.
Like what?
Well, the fact that some of these guys are actually working with us, which we've touched on earlier in this interview, and for example, I've learnt and I've indicated in my book that Los Alamos is not quite the place, Los Alamos in New Mexico, is not quite the place that you might think it is. I won't go into details, but I can tell you that the alien situation is foremost, is paramount in their work there at Los Alamos.
All most of us know about Los Alamos is where they tested the nuclear bomb, the big one.
Yes, in 1945.
And are we saying, I don't want to pull out of you more than you want to give, and I know you won't give it anyway, but...
I've given, there's a lot of information in the chapter. I mean, I don't want to give it all away, but...
No. But are you saying that the nuclear tests that happened there, all right, are we trying to say that some or all of that technology that made that terrible thing, that awesome power happen, might not entirely be ours?
No, I'm not trying to say that. I'm just trying to say that Los Alamos isn't all you think it is in those connections. It's much more associated with the alien situation.
And all this stuff we hear about secret underground bases that a lot of people talk about, what do you make of that?
There are plenty of those, both... military and alien bases. I was told, Stefano Breccia discovered, and other people told me that some of the bases were like 150 miles long undersea bases. Can you imagine that?
150
and the aliens
miles.
Create that by reducing matter to very, very dense levels and creating a base, you know, in a relatively short space of time with their technology. And then when they leave the base, it just becomes filled in again with, you know, the system they use for collapsing and developing rock material and whatever else is underground.
And it's interesting that these days we now have the technology, the satellite technology, and some of these pictures have appeared recently on the net, which is why I'm talking about it, to catalogue and chart the most amazing anomalies in our oceans.
Yes.
Great whirlpools, for example.
There's all sorts of satellites. Some of them, you know, can penetrate, I don't know how many feet into the Earth's oceans, and all types of filters for this and technologies which are probably still top secret, you know, to find out what's going under our oceans at great depths.
You know what people are talking about. You're connected into all of it. I have a friend called Gary who made contact with me recently, and... I went to school with Gary. I haven't seen him or spoken to him for a very, very, very long time.
Right.
Gary contacted me through my website, very keen to discuss something with me. So I phoned him up, and he expressed a great concern about a comet called Ison, or Ison, ISON, mm-hmm. That is said to be, what we know it is, incredibly close to us. But he was very concerned, I'm sure he won't mind me mentioning this, that there may be... Should we say deleterious effects coming from this comet, perhaps effects upon the sun which will impact upon us? Have you heard anything about that?
No, I haven't, Howard.
Okay.
But it's worrying, isn't it, if it's true?
If it's true, I mean, this comet does exist. It is out there, but it is something that... There are obscure postings on the net about it, and there are some astronomers who are talking about it, but there is a general theory that we're not quite being told the truth about this, and there may be all sorts of connections about it.
Yes.
But anyway, it's not something that you've looked into in depth. Maybe you might be told something if you are. Pass it on to me. What do you make about all this stuff that, for example, Richard Hoagland talks about? The Nazi bell. The Nazis' involvement with all of this alien technology, potentially. Do you think there's any credibility, credulity in any of that?
I would have to read it. I would have to read it. I think that certainly the Nazis were developing flying discs at one time. That we know. How far they got, I don't know. I mean, after all, in 1933, the Italian government picked up, recovered a crashed alien disc just outside Milan. Which has been written about in a book by two Italian writers, which is very good indeed.
And as we said before, where do we think this stuff is being kept? How can you keep something like that under wraps?
I imagine that it's easily done by those who have the ability and the technology to do that.
You're clearly very proud of the new book and the fact that people have divulged things to you. They've confided in you. What do you want to work on next, Tim? What are you? You must be planning the next one already.
Well, that one, I've never taken. It took me 2.5 years of hard work. I've never taken that long to write a book. But whether I'll write another one or not, I honestly don't know at the moment. I've written about a lot of things. I've covered a very wide spectrum. Now, you may be familiar with my stories of encounters with aliens in the United States in 1963 and 1967. Since that time, I've had a couple of other encounters, one of which I have described in great detail in the new book. And this was in Poland about seven years ago. And I was the guest of honor, whatever. I was the principal guest at a debating society to give a short 35-minute presentation on aliens and UFOs. And there were about, I guess, 80 people there from all walks of life, mostly retired politicians, doctors, ex-military. I could go into detail. Some of the military spoke. There were tremendous rows going on afterwards with all these people after I'd given my presentation. But throughout, I'd noticed someone who looked very similar to one of the guys that the guy I saw in New York in 1967. It wasn't him. It was a thinner version, but the timbre of the skin, the pale olive color was there, the immaculate hair, suit and everything, but he was thinner than the guy I saw in New York in 1967. But I thought, I'm going to talk to this guy, because I've never actually spoken to any of these people before. And he came past me. He was the last person to speak, and the subject of his short presentation, because I don't think anyone could speak for more than about 5 or 6 minutes, he was the last person to speak, and this was 11 o'clock by that time. We started at 7. He was the last person to give a short presentation. The title of his presentation was Earth's Future in Space. And I thought, well, you know, gosh, coming from someone who I think might be an alien, this could be worth listening to. So I was absolutely fascinated. At the end of the show, he came past me. I shook his hand. He looked at me in my eyes, completely unblinking, like a zombie. I mean, he was a nice-looking chap, very refined, immaculately dressed. He did not shake my hand. He did not grip it. He just looked into my eyes for a moment, and he did not speak at all. And I gave him my business card, and then he just walked off. By 5 minutes later, I had forgotten completely what he had spoken about, because I had said to him, I think you have a great deal of knowledge. And he just looked in my eyes. I think he must obviously have been hypnotizing me or doing something. But I then asked all the other people who were there, because a lot of people, and about, I would say, up to 10 of them were with a group. They were looking after me and taking me back to the castle where they were kindly putting me up in this converted Polish castle. And suddenly, I couldn't remember what this chap was talking about at all. And yet I'd been absolutely mesmerized by his talk. And I said, you know that guy, the last person to speak, what was he talking about? And they said, oh, yes, he was talking about Earth's future in space. I said, yes, but what did he say? Nobody could remember what he had said or for how long it went on.
That's extraordinary. There's always somebody who will have taken notes,
well,
or mental notes
thing.
At least.
The speaker, I was the guest of honor, is by contract supposed to get a tape of the proceedings.
Ah.
He's supposed to get all the details?
A transcript.
Transcript, thank you very much, of the presentation. All sorts of things I was supposed to get. I was supposed to get photographs of the people that were taken there, because there was a professional photographer taking pictures of the audience, all of them. I could not get hold of him, even though he'd given me I'd given him my contact details. I couldn't get in touch with anybody, including the guy, the professor, Professor Dudek, who's now deceased, to reply to any of my questions as to what was going on. Everything went silent. I couldn't get in touch with anybody except the friends who'd taken me to this presentation. None of them could remember what this chap had spoken about, and none of us ever will.
And this is not anything to do with the fact that this presentation was late in a long day?
Well, drink may have been involved, but I never touched a drop of alcohol until we got back to the castle at about midnight. I think a lot of other people were just drinking orange juice and stuff, but there were a lot of people there from all walks of life.
But for no one to remember is extraordinary, but it also begs the question of if this person was an alien, as you think that he was,
definitely,
and was talking about this, was he planting at some level in all of you, because you're an informed audience, the information that he wanted to impart, but you're not remembering it consciously?
Absolutely, because I remembered it at the time, and I was absolutely astonished. That's why I said to him, you know, I think you have a great deal of knowledge.
So in other words, it's the sort
later,
of stuff...
it's all gone.
But it's the sort of stuff that on some level maybe you do know.
Well, I, as yet nothing's happened, and that's what, nearly 8 years ago now. So it was quite disturbing.
How utterly extraordinary.
And then another thing is, I tried to get photographs. People said, why don't you talk to people? So I'd spoken to him. Why don't you try and get a photograph of these people? So before the time he actually came up to me, when he was sitting with just a few other people nearby, looking completely deadpan, I started taking pictures of some member of the audience before the second half of the show came back. And I was just using a small Minox at that time, and I needed to take three sections of the room, because there were a lot of people there. And when I got to the area where this guy was sitting, suddenly a voice boomed up from nowhere, from the back of the room, "The speaker's not allowed to take photographs." And I thought, oh God, I'm so sorry, but I didn't know who I was talking to, because I couldn't see anybody. That's the end of it, and I think that we were all given some information which is there subliminally.
What a fascinating story, which means that we have to talk again, Timothy Good, because our hour is done. But I wish you well with a new book, Tim, and I know that you're going to be going on the circuit to talk about this, and you must be very excited about going on with Art Bell on Sirius XM Radio.
Well, yes, if I can keep awake, as I say, it's going to be 3 in the morning till 7 in the morning.
Art will keep you awake.
Oh, good. I'm glad. It's been such a long time. I forget when it was. 2005, I think, was the last time we spoke.
Well, the last time I spoke to you was, I think, 2010. Or so.
Yes.
So it's been a while. I'm really pleased to see you back. 2.5 years of work on the book. Tell me the title again.
Earth, an Alien Enterprise, published by Pegasus Books, and it's due out this coming October, late October.
I wish you every success with it, Tim, and thank you for coming on here.
Thank you so much.
Always a truly remarkable guest and a fine speaker, Timothy Good. And there is a link to Timothy Good's work on my website, www.theunexplained.com. TV. If you're noticing anything different about the sound of this show, because I heard Art Bell return, and because his audio quality is always big and fat and warm, I've tried to make some changes to mine. Tell me what you think about that. And tell me what you think about this, too. Just email me, go to the website, you know where it is, www.theunexplained.tv, and tell me what you think of this new remixed version of our theme tune by Martin, the guy who created it. I want to get your thoughts before I start using it or something like it regularly. So go to the website and let me know. More great shows coming up in the pipeline. Yes, we do have David Paulides. I've just got to tie down a date for him. I've got his book already. Wow, that's a hell of a book. Those shows coming soon here at The Unexplained. My name is Howard Hughes. I am in London. Thank you very much for all of your support. Keep it coming. And I'll see you soon on another edition of The Unexplained.